the invitation to come. It's my first time here, first time in Ontario also, so it's nice to see snow on the ground at the right time of year. So I'm going to be talking about the Daedalus experiment and how that relates to dark matter. So this is work done with Gordon and some people at MIT and Fermilab. So I'll start off with the dark matter part of it and just remind you of the usual way that the dark matter search program goes. So there's this holy trinity of three kinds of experiments, the goal being to see eventually the same thing at all three experiments. And so there's direct detection, where we're trying to see dark matter that is just kind of floating around and bumps into something on Earth. There's indirect detection, where we look towards the center of our galaxy or other galaxies and try to see some signal of annihilation or decay. And then there's collider production, where you look for some missing energy signature. And the goal is to be able to really identify a dark matter candidate, is to see consistent signals at all three of these experiments, which hasn't quite happened yet. So now I'll briefly mention why you might be interested in MEV dark sector, as opposed to the WIMP story that you've probably usually heard about, where you're looking for dark matter that's around the weak scale. So there are several reasons why it might be interesting to extend the search to lower masses like this. So just a couple of them. So there's a persistent anomaly in the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon. It's been high by like 3.6 sigma for some like 30 years. And as Maxime pointed out, you can rectify this with the addition of some MEV to GEV scale mediator particle, which can then bring G minus 2 of the muon in agreement between experiment and theory. And so here's just a recent plot of, I guess it's not showing up too well on the screen, but so the mass of the mediator is down here, and then some parameter telling you how strongly it couples to charged particles over here, and there's some band, which is not yet excluded by other measurements, which can be explained by an MEV scale mediator particle. There's the WIMP miracle, which I put in quotes here, because it's not really a WIMP miracle. It's just sort of a coincidence of scales that tells you what you need to do in order to get the right relic density of dark matter. And it turns out that you don't actually need a weak scale particle. If you have a mediator particle, which is considerably lighter than your dark matter particle, then the scale which shows up in the problem is the dark matter mass rather than the mediator mass. And it's fine to put that thing at about an MeV, and or around MeV to 100 MeV. You might end up with a subdominant component of dark matter, but then again, we don't really know anything about dark matter yet, and there could be a whole dark sector with some subdominant states. And this might be one of them. So it's worth looking, because the numerics work out about as well as they do in the hand wavy sense for the WIMP miracle. Then there's some hints from indirect detection. So there's an excess of positrons at the center of our galaxy that was very robustly discovered in 2008 by looking at the 511 kV gamma ray line, which comes from the eventual annihilation of those positrons. And there's a lot of activity in thinking this might be related to either light dark matter particles or heavy dark matter particles with a light mediator, where light here again means the MeV scale. So I'm not trying to give you any convincing evidence for any of this, but just enough of a flavor of why you might be interested in looking at a dark sector, which is a couple orders of magnitude lighter than the usual picture. And this kind of dark matter is easily missed in the standard WIMP searches. Basically, it's too light for colliders. You're not going to get enough missing energy to really see a distinctive signature. It's too slow for direct detection, meaning that its kinetic energy is too low to ever give you a nuclear recoil, which you'll be able to see. And usually there's too much background for indirect detection if this thing is annihilating, because then you just get kind of some low energy gamma rays, and those are swamped by other astrophysical sources. The exception being this kind of unusual case here, where you have annihilation to E plus E minus, then those things later on annihilate. But again, this signature is not unambiguous. So. Okay. Yeah, okay, that's true. Yeah, but I mean, then again, you still have the problems of the other two branches of the triumvirate there. So there's a particular class of experiments which are well suited to looking for NV scale dark matter. And those are fixed target experiments, which is kind of reminiscent of 1960s physics in a fun way. I mean, you slam an electron or a proton or something into some fixed target. Here I've just drawn an example diagram, so you can have an electron coming in. It can scatter off either a positron or a proton or some nucleus. And then you can just look for missing energy. And there are numerous proposals to do this. So VEP3 is a proposal to do this with positrons. Actually, in that case, I believe it's positrons colliding with a fixed electron. The dark light experiment, which I work on at MIT, is doing this with a proton. And then there is a new PI proposal from a couple weeks ago, which is doing this with high energy electrons off of nuclei. So that's sort of like the collider, like the low energy version of the collider production piece of this trinity. But what's nice about these kinds of experiments is you can actually do two of the things at once. You can produce dark matter and then later on detect it downstream. So the idea here is you produce some mediator particle which then decays into dark matter. And then later on, after it passes through some rock or dirt or beamed up or something, you have some detector placed on the other side which then looks for the rescattering of these dark matter particles. And it can rescatter again off either electrons or nuclei, protons, neutrons, whatever you want. I think one of the earliest papers that pointed out this idea was again from Maxime, which said that you can take existing data from the LS&D neutrino experiment and reinterpret it as if you were looking for a rescattering. Then there's also a recent interpretation of the E137 beamed up experiment at SLAC, which did exactly that same reinterpretation. And then some things that Gordon and other people here work on, the beamed up experiment, which is a dedicated search to do this kind of thing. So what I want to point out is that neutrino experiments are especially well suited to doing this kind of production and detection search, both to save money because the experiments are generally already there or are being designed, but also because neutral current neutrino scattering looks like dark matter scattering. The signals are basically the same, and you can not only use their beam, but you can also use their detector. And so having the same signals and the same detectors means that it's nice to be able to piggyback on some existing physics program. So the particular model of an MEV dark sector that I'm going to deal with is one which I think some people are pretty familiar with, which is this dark photon model. So briefly going through it, it has four parameters, which is the kinetic mixing between the dark photon and the photon electromagnetism. Here I've written it in terms of the B, but then once you after electroweak symmetry breaking happens, then you eventually get a coupling of the photon. This thing has to get a mass if you want to avoid dark particles having electric Miller charges. I don't really care so much where that mass comes from. It could be a Stuckelberg or a dark Higgs, but that's just another parameter in the model. And then I'm going to assume that I have some fermions which have gauge couplings to this dark photon. So there's a dark gauge coupling and then some mass for the fermions. And the choice of fermions instead of scalars is really just one of concreteness. You can run exactly the same arguments for scalars. The key feature here is that this kinetic mixing, that first operator up there, gives dark particles a universal coupling to electromagnetism. Particularly, the dark photon gets a coupling to the electromagnetic current, which comes with a factor of this kinetic mixing. And read another way, that just says that any source of photons is also a source of dark photons, and because of this gauge coupling of dark matter. The replacement you need to make is the alpha of electromagnetism gets multiplied by a factor of this kinetic mixing squared. Whenever you look at diagrams which give you photons. So the point is that this parameter space is four-dimensional. And the full parameter space is worth exploring, despite the fact that plots that you might be used to seeing are two-dimensional. And there's a very standard way of presenting these results. Mm-hmm. So over here, if you think of this dark photon being able to decay into standard model particles, the usual presentation is you put the dark photon mass on one axis and the kinetic mixing on the other axis. This is nice because you don't have to assume anything about this chi particle. So maybe there isn't any dark matter state. Maybe there's just a dark photon and there's no associated dark matter particle. And then you can set some bounds, and so that's nice. Then again, if you want to ask about the decays of this dark photon into dark matter particles, or invisible as it's called here, you have to make some sort of a choice. You have to make a choice for both the dark gauge coupling, so here they chose alpha dark is 0.1, and the mass of the dark matter particle. And then you can draw the same axes. So there's four parameters, and so if you want to interpret results in terms of dark matter, then you have to make a choice for the dark matter properties, and then you're left with two more parameters. So what I want to convince you of is that plots like this actually are intimately related to plots like this through off-shell dark photons. So if you look here, unfortunately, it's not showing up so well here, but they're bounds from the LS&D experiment. So this is from the big Dark Sector review, which came out about a year ago for the Snowmass meeting. And so these bounds have changed since then, but just to give you an illustration. So there are bounds from the LSD experiment of the kind that I described, reinterpreting it as a dark matter experiment, which unfortunately you can't see here, but they seem to cut off very sharply here and here. So those two mass scales here are twice the dark matter mass, saying that above that mass, the A prime or dark photon can decay into two dark matter particles.
I did bring this issue up with the master plotters, and they, you know, I said, well, it cannot be a sharp cutoff, right? Well, of course, everyone agrees.
Okay, yeah. Sure. I mean, yeah. So I'm sure I'm not the first one to say this, but just to go through the argument. So as Maxime was pointing out, so there are no sharp cutoffs here because, of course, you can. However this dark matter is produced, you don't need to go directly into an on-shell dark photon. You could just produce the dark matter directly. There's always off-shell diagrams, and I'll describe to you exactly how that works. But the point is that once you're in a regime where on-shell production of the A prime to dark matter is suppressed, then actually bounds from visible decays start to feed in. And really what should go in this region are a bunch of these bounds from visible searches, because if it's kinematically forbidden for an on-shell dark photon to go to dark matter, but instead it can go to visible particles, then those searches are going to start to constrain this regime here.
So let's say the Dalitz branching of pi zero is worth a few percent, right?
Yeah.
So you lose a factor of 100, but then you take a loop of fourth power there, right? And then, so, I mean, if I look at the right plot, right? The difference between this plot and you know, this thing where the where your arrow
this thing
the plateau, right? The
what's the color of the nine?
No, referring to the fact that this plateau that you can draw, right? It's roughly like the root of the fourth power from whatever penalty you take on the branching of the galaxy. So it's roughly the right factor.
Right. Right, so yeah, so I think your point is that three-body decays are not as bad as you might have thought.
Sure.
Yeah,
because... Especially when you take
you're dealing with
the fourth power from whatever small number, right? It helps them.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, so basically the takeaway from this is that that drawing plots like this doesn't quite show all the data. If you make some choice about the dark sector, then necessarily, depending on the various kinematic thresholds, you're going to have to also include constraints on visibly decaying dark photons. So this is a way to sort of connect these two different types of searches, which at least in the community that works on this stuff have traditionally been kind of separate papers, separate experiments even. So just to outline where I'm going to go, I'm going to tell you how I can produce MeV scale dark matter at this Daedalus experiment. I'll tell you what Daedalus is and what it's originally supposed to do and how we're going to commandeer it to do a dark matter search. I'm going to tell you how you would detect that at a neutrino detector called LINA that was already in the proposal to pair this neutrino source with. I'll tell you about the backgrounds that you might find you have to contend with for such a search, which actually turned out to be pretty surprising from a perspective of how far you have to go in very, very small branching ratio processes that end up being your main backgrounds. And then tell you about some sensitivities of this experiment as compared to existing searches and existing bounds. So start off with production processes, but first I'll tell you about this Daedalus experiment. So their idea is to measure the CP violating phase in the neutrino mixing matrix using a multi-baseline decay at rest experiment. So what they want is they want to look for anti-nu mu to anti-nu e oscillations, and eventually what they want is three neutrino sources, which are going to be cyclotrons, so 800 MeV proton machines on some nuclear target, and they're going to fire them all at the same detectors. And the idea is to have the closest one be the thing that constrains the flux, and then to put one of them at the oscillation maximum for a given neutrino energy, and have the other one as sort of a cross-check. So three cyclotron sources are expensive. One would obviously be less expensive. And the nice thing is that we can do exciting physics with just one of them. And so you can think of this dark matter search as a component of the Daedalus program, which lets them demonstrate both the working of the neutrino source cyclotron machine and also do some good physics with just one of them before they get all three of their cyclotrons and can do their delta CP measurement.
So, just as a sociological question, maybe these people take their own anomalies more seriously, right? So this is all LSD inspired, right? Otherwise, why would they do that, right? I mean, like, LSD has a discrepant result. This is all
the checklist. I mean, not being from the neutrino community, I can't say necessarily, but I mean, the point of LSD is not specifically to measure delta CP, right?
Oh, delta CP.
Yeah.
This is for delta CP.
This D should be a delta. I mean, that's
so
what.
This is very canonical, non anomaly driven. Okay.
Where is this stuff supposed to be?
I'll tell you that. So one proposal is in Finland, and the other one is, I think, somewhere near Gran Sasso. Actually, probably dangerous to put any neutrino experiment near Gran Sasso. None of this has happened so far.
Okay.
I mean, but the idea is that these distances are not very big. I mean, so this stuff would all go in the same general area. Okay, so let me just tell you what the machine is that's going to be making these neutrinos. So here's some nice schematic drawing of a cyclotron, but the idea being this is just a machine that generates 800 MeV protons, which then get dumped onto some graphite and copper target.
What's the length scale of that of any sort? What's
how big is this thing? I think like tens of meters. Yeah, it's not enormous. It weighs a lot, but it's not enormous. I mean, because this is like again sort of like older technology. I mean, so the Daedalus proposal goes through a nice review of the history of cyclotrons from, like, you know, 1930 all the way. So it's nice, you know, recovering sort of old physics techniques to do new physics. So then what happens is stuff comes flying out of here. Neutrinos, you have some electrons, you have some photons, then I'll also tell you how you can get some dark matter particles out. And then it's a specialized target whose goal is to stop as many charged ions as it can. Because what they want is they want essentially these monochromatic neutrino beams coming from the decay pi goes to nu mu, and because that lets them, I think, do their delta CP measurement a little more easily. So the idea is that all the neutrinos that you get out of this target are mostly produced from decays at rest, and we're going to exploit that kinematics to do a dark matter search. So in this setup, the dark matter production is mostly from neutral pions. The reason being as follows. I told you that in this context, this dark photon model, any process which gives you a photon can also give you a dark photon. And so you just take the usual pi zero to gamma gamma decay and replace one of the legs with the dark photon, and then you glue on some dark matter particles. So this is the diagram that you're looking at. And so this tells you that your neutrino source is also a dark matter source. And it turns out that at these energies, we've checked that pi zeros are the main production mechanism. You can also get photons from other stuff, Bremsstrahlung, delta decay, but these end up being subdominant. So here's the squared amplitude for this thing, and the point is just that it's proportional to epsilon squared, this kinetic mixing parameter, but also the dark gauge coupling that comes from this vertex. So I've drawn this for a very particular reason as a full three-body process. So it's pi zero goes to gamma chi bar. And not pi zero goes to gamma a prime and then a prime goes to chi bar, because as I'll say in just a second, that's an approximation which is not necessarily true if you sweep over the whole range of parameter space. And just one nice setup about the fact that the dark matter comes from neutral pions, which decay very fast, rather than charged pions, which decay some more slowly, is they don't lose any energy. They basically decay before they can lose energy, and so they retain whatever small boost they have from your 800 MeV beam, which also increases the kinematic separation. And lets you separate some signal from background.
Can I ask a question back to the cyclotrons?
Yes.
So how does the luminosity plan for Daedalus compare to, like, I mean, I assume there are other cyclotrons out there, say, in
time. Right. So they're looking for, like, Avogadro's number of protons on target per year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's like, so they expect 10 times the luminosity from compared to LSD after only 1 year of running. Yeah, I mean, it's like macroscopic numbers of protons. I mean, yeah, so they're just, you know. So this is the luminosity frontier.
I thought
23.
That was over the entire lifetime of the experiment. So this is going to have 5 times 10 to the 23 per year.
6 times 10 to the 23 is a graph.
I thought you had only run for a quarter of a year or so.
Sorry?
What are they doing to get that boost in velocity?
So that I don't know. I think that as theorists, we were just trying to take their cyclotrons to black box. They say we can get this luminosity, and great, we'll take it.
You said old technology, but it says superconducting.
Sure, the idea of a cyclotron is old, but it's...
Okay, well, superconductors were discovered 100 years ago.
When I see the cyclotron, superconducting is the last word that comes to mind.
Right.
When you look at it.
Okay, so the point that I was making about three-body decays is that if your parameters are arranged in such a way like this, that you can have kinematically allowed decays of pi zero to gamma A prime, that's why this mass has to be less than that one, and then kinematically allowed decays of A prime to chi's, so that you need this mass hierarchy, then you're allowed to use the narrow width approximation, which basically says you're allowed to factorize this amplitude into two pieces, production of the A prime, and then later decay of the A prime. So that roughly corresponds to this piece and that piece. And you'll notice that there's no longer any factor of the dark gauge coupling in this vertex. The reason being, you have a factor in the amplitude of 1 over the width, and the width carries a factor of alpha dark, and that cancels the factor of alpha dark from this vertex. So in this approximation, this thing only depends on the kinetic mixing parameter. However, there is still a non-zero three-body amplitude for this whole process to go, even when you're outside of this mass range. In that case, all you have is an off-shell dark photon. And in that case, it doesn't really make sense to talk about branching ratios anymore. This is just a three-body process. You calculate the amplitude that tells you the production rate of chi-chi from pion decays. And here's the expression. There's some phase-phase integral you can't do, but you can parameterize it in terms of two-body phase-phase and the mass of the virtual A prime. And in that case, you no longer get the cancellation. This thing depends on the dark gauge coupling. But this thing doesn't have any sharp kinematic cutoffs. So as Maxime was pointing out, you're not going to get any vertical lines on plots just because you cross epsilonically across this mass threshold. You're just going to now move into the regime where the narrow width approximation is no longer valid. So it's important to be a little bit careful. And actually, what we found is these ranges are not sharp cutoffs either. There's a range in which, basically, if your kinematically allowed regime is not integrating over the entire peak of the Wright-Wigner, then it's best to just use the three-body matrix element to interpolate between things. Because this is a nice approximation, which holds very well in the standard model, especially for, you use kind of formula all the time when you talk about Higgs, production times branching ratio. But basically, that's because there are no mass coincidences in the standard model which would make you run into problems like this. If you're sweeping over a whole unknown four-dimensional parameter space, you may well run into situations like this, and there's no harm in using the full three-body process. And in particular, what we'll find is that you can get sensitivity to dark photon masses well above the pion mass. So just because you're producing the dark matter from pions doesn't mean that you're not allowed to produce any A primes which are heavier than the pion. And so that opens up a whole extra sort of half line of parameter space that that if you had just thought in this context, you might have thought was absent.
What about deltas? Do they contribute?
They do. They're still subdominant. They contribute in a very particular region of parameter space, which I'll show you near the end of the talk. Remember, yeah, because we're at 800 MeV. If you were working at higher energies, then of course they contribute more. But the idea from this is that basically all of your pions are produced from the delta resonance, and so you're not going to have deltas have enough kinetic energy to give you high-energy photons, and yeah. Okay, so now dark matter detection at this LINA neutrino detector. So to answer your question about where this stuff is, so there's a proposal for a 100-meter-long neutrino detector to be buried deep in a mine in the center of Finland. So this is already a proposal from 2011. So this is an idea which has been around for a while, which we and the Daedalus Project are hoping to co-op. So it really is an underground American football field filled with laundry detergent. So the material that you use for detection is this linear alkyl benzene, which is basically like laundry detergent, which has nice scintillation properties, which is great. So we're going to use this as an example of a large luminosity frontier neutrino detector. But basically, any big neutrino detector you can bury underground to reduce backgrounds would be fine to pair with this Daedalus experiment. The idea being that Daedalus is the cyclotrons, and you need to pair it with a detector to eventually see your neutrinos. This one is one example, but there are other proposals. Juno, Hyper-K, which is even a factor of 10 bigger than this in terms of volume. So these things are really going to be enormous. So I saw a couple neutrino talks where they were like putting this inside the Statue of Liberty, or sorry, putting the Statue of Liberty inside of this thing, you know, or like comparing it to the New York skyline. Like, it's ridiculous. So, you know, great. Large detectors sitting around are great for dark matter. So the process by which you see dark matter at a detector like this is through electron scattering. And this might be slightly surprising if you're used to thinking about direct detection experiments, because you're always talking about nuclear scattering. The problem is you have light MeV scale dark matter, which is going to transfer a lot of energy or momentum through scattering. And that large momentum transfer gives you a really strong form factor suppression. So it turns out that at these energy scales and for these masses, the process that is most important is actually electron scattering rather than nuclear scattering. So this is a diagram, and the thing that mediates the scattering is the same particle that you use to produce the dark matter. So in this sense, you really are testing the same thing. It's the same mediator which both produces and then later lets you detect the dark matter.
Sorry, can you say where this form factor suppression is coming from? I mean, 100 MeV scale momentum exchange should be totally difficult. Not substantially suppressed, right?
So, we checked this and it turns out the electron scattering.
I certainly believe that the electron scattering is more visible.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe highly isn't the right word. So it's not invisible. What's going to matter most for us is electron scattering. But Gordon can definitely tell you more about that.
We checked this, and this signal was better.
But is it mainly a detection threshold issue or a form factor issue? I guess that's what I'm asking.
I think it's just the recoil distribution.
Okay.
We'll see these
kinematics. Yeah.
For the same reason that in BDX you want to be
But the scintillation efficiency. Also, if it's linear, right, it's much, much lower for the recoil of protons or for electrons. Right?
That's right.
The quenching factor really is.
Yeah,
right.
Plus the momentum of the.
Right. Sure, but then, you know, if it turned out that the nuclear scattering signal was the biggest, you'd want to pair it with another detector. I mean, so in this case, Lena is the right thing to do because it has electron targets and lets you do this, but. The detector issue is a thing that I'll also come back to, showing you how this compares to the existing things from LS&D. So here's a formula for how many signal events you expect. And this looks basically just like a direct detection formula. So you have some geometry factor, which tells you, some angle-dependent path length through the detector, which tells you the effective density of targets. You have some energy cuts on the electron recoil, and I'll briefly describe you where those come from and how you might use them to reduce backgrounds. And then you have a cross-section, which again is proportional to this kinetic mixing squared times alpha dark from this vertex. And that factor of alpha dark never goes away. So your rates are always going to scale with the dark gauge coupling. And they're also always going to come with this extra factor of epsilon squared. So part of the motivation behind this new PI proposal for the missing momentum search is if you never have to look at that second half of the diagram, you never get this extra penalty factor. But then again, you're never directly detecting the dark matter that you produced, so they're complementary. And then there's some minimum energy of the incident dark matter required to induce an electron recoil at energy EE. So this is just like the Vmin for direct detection experiments, some minimum incident velocity you need to get a certain recoil, and it's a formula that looks like this. And basically, what this is saying is that most of your signal comes from when the dark matter has lots of energy, so the high energy tail of the dark matter production distribution. So there are a couple of possible geometries you can think about. So the original setup for Daedalus said that the closest you would ever get the detector is like 1.5 kilometers. So we're going to try to be a little bit insane and put the detector like 20 meters away from the source. And we've checked with neutrino people. And they said that's fine. And so you can imagine either actually just bearing this thing facing down and firing it down, or you can maybe have some magnets that bend the beam or something. But you can imagine other geometries which might be more physically realizable. You could maybe bury the source halfway underground and have it fire at the side.
But did they themselves talk about putting it
I think they don't really care, because all they ever use that near one for is to constrain the flux. And so then they just multiply by some angular acceptance factor, and you know, it doesn't really matter for them. But for us, well, we thought that what we want is the highest angular coverage possible. It turns out actually that because of our systematics on backgrounds, it doesn't really matter. But if you were able to fix that, it'd be advantageous to get as many events in your detector as possible. So basically, so we ran some simulations and tried to figure out what our sensitivity would be for all three of these geometries, and basically you can't even see the difference between the curves.
Does the background come from mostly from
Eugene? I'll get to that in a second, yeah. The point being that it turns out that the relevant background distributions are very similar to the signal, and so it doesn't really matter how you don't get any additional kinematic separation from doing some kind of crazy geometry. So basically you can put this thing wherever you want, and you can get basically the same results. So what this is saying is you can piggyback on existing neutrino setups. I mean, basically, like wherever they wanted to put their cyclotrons, say great, and you can basically run the dark matter experiment at exactly the same time. You don't need to like move something off target. Okay, so because Maxime asked about it, let me tell you about backgrounds. So this is again sort of different from the usual high energy collider philosophy, in that events that have totally different final states can look the same in your detector because of your detector's limited capabilities in some way. So in our case, any event which gives you a single energetic charged lepton is a potential background to dark matter elastically scattering off electrons. Because the signal is dark matter, electron, you don't see the dark matter, all you see is the electron. So if your detector tells you you've got a high energy something and nothing else, then that's indistinguishable from your signal. And so all sorts of processes you thought might not be important turn out to be important. So for example, you can have muons that fake electrons. If the muon doesn't decay fast enough, it can look just like an electron in a scintillator detector. So the irreducible background is, of course, just neutrino elastic scattering off electrons. So looks just like your signal, same kinematics, same final state. That's something we always have to deal with. But you also have charge current quasi-elastic scattering, where basically you're turning a neutron into a proton or a proton into the neutron, depending on the flavor of the neutrino. And the reason this is a background is, as Maxime pointed out earlier, the nuclear activity, a really soft nucleus kind of dribbling out of a high energy collision with a lepton coming out, is indistinguishable from just having the lepton there. Basically, you just get a ball of light, in the words of the neutrino experimentalists. So these are also going to be backgrounds. And even when you have a muon neutrino, which then produces a muon is different from an electron, but it can look the same at your detector. So that might also be a background. The handle that we have on this is that the recoil spectra have sharp cutoffs. For example, you need a minimum kinetic energy of the neutrino to even produce a muon for that kind of background. And distinctive kinematics. For example, they're more isotropic in angle than the signal tends to be. But this is a huge source which we have to contend with, and originally we thought that wasn't really going to matter that much. The reason this is a killer is that the cross-section compared to elastic scattering basically goes like m nucleon over m electron. So it's like 1,000 times more probable. And so things that you thought were going to be negligible turn out not to be. So first I'll tell you about the things that don't matter, which are beam off backgrounds. So any experiment that's aiming for a high sensitivity has to deal with these kinds of things. But burying your detector underground renders everything except for atmospheric neutrinos negligible. So that's sort of the goal of burying this thing deep underground. And the point to get from this table is just that all these numbers are small. These are 1 year rates. So you get like order like at most 10 events from some process. However, this is the process where you produce a muon, and 70% of the time you can tag that muon. The other 30% escapes. So basically you want to multiply this row by 0.3, and like everything in this table is less than 10. Okay, so small manageable rates for beam off backgrounds, and even better, you can measure them because you have a duty cycle of your beam, and so in the time that it's off, you can count the number of events you see.
What's the exact structure of the beam?
So it's 75% beam off and 25% beam on. I don't remember off the top of my head. But Gordon, do you?
No, I just remember when we found out that it was essentially continuous wave you stopped caring.
So it's very short.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, it doesn't give you much of a handle for using backgrounds beyond the 70%.
Yeah. Okay, So here I'm going to lead you through a cartoon of all the beam on backgrounds you might have to worry about. So this is just in order of increasing kinetic energy of the thing that you think is an electron. So it could be an electron or muon. So this is a lot of information. Let me go through it step by step. So at the lowest energies, you have a bunch of decay at rest, though. So DAR stands for decay at rest. So you stop, you have pions, and you stop them because they lose a bunch of energy due to hadronic collisions. They eventually decay into mu pluses and nu mus. And this thing, for a decay at rest, this thing has a monochromatic spectrum. Then you can also have the muons, which then are produced, gradually slow down, stop, decay at rest, and then you also get some more neutrinos from that. But the highest energy neutrino you're ever going to get out of that is the so-called Michel threshold, which is 52.8 MeV. So you're never going to get out any neutrinos which are higher energy than 52.8 MeV from the decay at rest. And the point is that Daedalus is supposed to be an experiment which is stopping all of the pions and getting everything happening at rest. And so we're going to look for a signal at higher energies than that. So you might say, oh, great, so just put your threshold at 52.8 MeV and look above that. But then you have to remember that you also have this helicity suppressed decay mode where pi plus goes to e plus nu e. And because this thing is monochromatic, but this thing is almost massless, this thing gets like half the energy of the pion. So it's actually got a threshold at 70 MeV. And you might say, oh, great, well, the branching ratio is 10 to the minus 4. Why do I care? And the answer is because the charge current cross section is almost that factor of 10 to the 4 higher. So this thing could choose just as much as that. So if you want to avoid this, you have to work above 70 MeV. And then you go, oh no, but what about the muons that I produce from pi minuses that decay in flight? And so you have some high energy muon, and then that muon slows down and captures and produces a neutrino. Okay, there you can get a neutrino which has energy all the way up to the muon mass. So if you want to reduce backgrounds, really your floor is 106 MeV. This is different from the LSND setup, which looked at low energies, and it's basically because your detector, this LENA detector, does not have very good sensitivity to low energy stuff. So in particular, it can't resolve angles very well for low energy things. And so we're going to be doing sort of a high energy window search. Okay, so then there's a whole ton of processes that you worry about. So you have everything decaying in flight. You can have elastic or charge current processes, and you can have muons faking electrons. So sort of everything contributes here. Above 147 MeV, none of your neutrinos are ever energetic enough to produce a muon. So that's just, it's a function of the kinematics of your beam. You have an 800 MeV beam that gives you some maximum neutrino energy, and therefore some maximum kinetic energy of the muon that you produce. So above this, some processes stop contributing, and you have about equal contributions from elastic scattering from the neutrinos resulting from these things decaying in flight. And then also this really annoying charge current quasi-elastic scattering, but now from the decay in flight of the pi pluses. And now, instead of being at 70 MeV, this thing is highly boosted, and you have some enormous spectrum extending all the way up almost to like 700 MeV. And in fact, that's the last thing which survives. So you can look at higher and higher and higher energies, and you're always going to have this helicity-suppressed decay inducing a neutrino which then undergoes charge-current quasi-elastic scattering, and that looks just like your signal. So this was a surprise for us. But the point is that this is really the floor. So we're going to be looking in this range because anything down here would totally sink us.
So what's the fraction of pi pluses that decays in flight?
So it's something like 10 to the minus 3, but you have so many pions that it doesn't matter. Like, you know, there's only so many pions that you can stop, I mean, unless you make your target sort of infinitely thick. I mean, and then again, some of them are just going to decay in flight because, you know, you have some exponential spectrum and you're never going to stop them all. So it's unclear how much better you can do by trying to specialize the target more than the Daedalus people are already doing. I mean, this stuff is annoying for them, not this particular process, because they don't care about new E's, they only care about new mu bars, but they want to stop as much stuff as possible, so.
Yeah. So can you comment, how does that compare to stop pion fraction by LSD,
for instance? So LSD is confusing because there was a decay in flight component to their beam, and so roughly the same amount of pions got through, but they also their targets were set up such that you had like some, for example, some muons that decayed in flight downstream. So the main difference between us and LSND was that the LSND analysis, which gives these limits on dark photons, was looking at the 18 to 52 MeV range. So it was looking way down here, and that was a function not so much of the of the production, but of the detection. That's just what the detector was optimized for. So they were able to reject these decay in flight or decay at rest backgrounds that we can't. So that's basically the main difference. Okay, so we have one more handle which we can play with, which is the angular kinematics of the backgrounds. So I don't have it up here, but basically the charge current quasi-elastic events give you an isotropic lepton. So the lepton comes out at whatever angle it wants. And this black curve is the elastic neutrino angular distribution. And again, that's pretty close to isotropic. So it rises slightly in the forward direction, but the signal rises more. And so you can keep most of your signal by just looking at events which give you a lepton which is very close to the angle of your beamline. So we pick.
Specifically, why is that? Is it just because the pi naughts are higher energy?
Why is what?
Why is there a different beacon structure for the signal?
Oh, for the signal. Yeah, it's basically because the pi naughts don't lose energy.
Okay.
And so you have a boosted spectrum for your dark matter, and you don't have the same boosted spectrum for the neutrinos. All right, so this comes from, so the neutrinos came from a Jayon simulation. Everything came from a giant simulation. It gave you pi zeros as well as pi pluses and minuses. We decayed everything, looked at the angles.
Roughly, what's the average energy that the pi naughts come out
with? Let's see. So I think it peaks at like hundreds of MeV kinetic energy. So yeah. I'll show you a spectrum of at least the electron recoil in a couple slides, and that should give you some information on how that looks. So even after we exploit this, even after we cut off everything that's at wider angles, just look, eyeballing these rates compared to the previous table, you get thousands of background events per year. And even in this higher energy range, you never get rid of this charge current quasi-elastic process that comes from the 10 to the minus 4 branching ratio holistically just suppressed pion decay. And amusingly, this thing is not even implemented in the out-of-the-box version of Jayon. So it doesn't matter so much for neutrino simulations that they don't even turn on this this decay mode. But it turns out to be our main background at both low and high energies. At low energies, it's the muons that are faking the electrons. And at high energies, it's just that you have a CCQE process which gives you an energetic electron.
So you wonder what do they mean to the
time. Well, maybe.
Right?
I mean, probably there's a way of turning it on. So, but you, yeah, I mean, you have to start worrying about all sorts of things that. Right.
So what did you guys did call
this? Good. So what we did is we took the spectrum of pions from Jayon and then multiplied that by 10 to the minus 4 and then just decay them two body. Which is fine for the two-body decay. So if you notice, I put these processes in parentheses. So this might also matter for exactly the same reasons. We think they're subdominant based on estimating what the relative rates would be compared to LS&D, but that process is very hard to simulate. Basically, we ran Jayon for like something like 2 million events and only got like 200 muons, which is not nearly enough to build the spectrum and even do the decay yourself. We estimated that this would be subdominant, but in a careful experiment, you would definitely have to care about it. Okay, but there's a persistent issue with all of this, which is uncertainties in the backgrounds. And so the question is, how does the background rate scale with the number of events? Like, if you were doing a counting experiment and everything was statistic limited, you'd be able to say that your background scaled like root b, and your sensitivity would go like number of signal events over square root of number of background events. It turns out that at neutrino experiments, generically, that's not true because there are large systematic uncertainties in all the processes used to measure how many neutrinos do you even produce. And so at every neutrino experiment, there's this issue of flux calibration, which is basically that these nuclear processes have these large systematic uncertainties, especially comparing different theoretical predictions and even experiment to theory. So here's some theory prediction, and then here's a bunch of experimental data for some charge current process. And the point is, these don't match up very well at all, and they have order 10-20% uncertainties. And so our BMON background rate is going to be systematics dominated. And by talking to some neutrino experts, they convinced us that a 20% systematic uncertainty everywhere is healthily optimistic, but not insane. And there are efforts to get this down to something closer to 10%, but there's a problem of sort of a dog chasing its tail in that at neutrino experiments that are trying to measure this, they use elastic scattering as their calibration process. Well, no, I mean, like, so this is...
It's a
1 GeV. This is 1 GeV.
Well, I mean, there's lots of...
Okay.
I mean, QCD stuff going on, so that's way below that.
So that's true. We were convinced that there were... Even comparing different simulations trying to do the same thing gave rather different results. And in fact, one really confusing thing for us is we tried to simulate the CCQE process just to get a sense of what the rates would be. We did it totally naively without implementing any poly blocking at all. And we got exactly the answer that the giant neutrino simulation gave us, which seems totally bizarre. And so already, I mean, at the level that we're concerned with, that might even be the 20% uncertainty. There's some process or phenomenon that we're missing, or that there's some reason why the neutrino simulation gives like the naive answer rather than the answer you'd expect from polyblocking of the nucleons. But so we have not resolved this, but we're basically just taking this to see how well we can do if we say the best we can do is a 20% uncertainty. So here are two plots, one of the optimal window of electron recoils that you want depending on the dark matter mass, and then one of the spectra of the recoil electrons, or things that look like electrons in your detector. So I'll just lead you through this starting over here. So the black is a spectrum from nu mu elastic scattering, and the red, blue, and green curves are signal recoil spectra for various dark matter masses. And so what you can see is that comparing, for example, the black to the blue or the black to the red, they basically look the same. Like they're different at low energies, but at the high energy tail, the slope is increasing in the downward direction as you go to heavier dark matter masses. But basically, like this thing is parallel to that thing for a while. And so the signal and background kinematics, at least for elastic scattering, are very similar. The charge current processes look rather different. So this new E CCQE is basically flat and just extends for a very, very wide range of energies. And the nu mu CCQE also looks like the signal, but in fact, down here you can see again this factor between the elastic scattering and the CCQE, which is pretty large. So these are all backgrounds we have to contend with. And the fact that if you just sort of scan through this plot, you see that some sort of CCQE process is basically important everywhere. And so in order to reduce that, you want to look in some window on this axis, which is as small as you can get, to basically pick out the peak of where the signal will kind of stick out just a little bit over the background. And we just did this as a simulation. We scanned over these distributions and found what is the optimal S over B. And it turns out that, as I suggested, you need a signal window which is as small as possible. So you might go, oh, great. Well, so why don't I just, because this is the only process which matters out here, why don't I just take my window to be higher than something like 200 MeV everywhere? The problem being that as your dark matter gets heavier, you don't have as much kinetic energy available to provoke that scattering. And so for a 20 MeV dark matter, or a 40 MeV dark matter particle, you basically never have anything which gives you kinetic energy large enough to get an electron recoil above like 120. So that doesn't work. So basically what you need to do is draw as narrow a window as possible across the whole range of dark matter masses, which sort of gradually increases, meaning you want to look at higher energy scatterings for lighter dark matter. But this curve is limited by the maximum electron recoil you can have for a given dark matter mass, given our beam energy. And so ideally, you want an experiment which can probe this entire thing. But you have this enormous region at light dark matter masses, which is totally inaccessible, because trying to increase your window just lets in so much more of this broad CCQE spectrum while your signal spectrum is falling, which kind of sucks. And so it'd be nice if there was some way to get rid of this, but the neutrino people have told me that it's very difficult to distinguish this kind of CCQE from a signal process, because they're not producing a muon anymore. It's just neutron goes to electron proton, and you've just got a proton coming out, and it's coming out, and it's pretty soft, and at a detector like this, you're never going to see it. So the width of this thing is basically set by what is the smallest window that neutrino physicists think is reasonable to ask for in a detector like this. And so we picked 50 MeV out of a hat. You would all obviously want to optimize this for a real experiment. Okay, so let me summarize how this setup is different than the LSND results, which you may already be familiar with. The main difference is just the fact that we're looking at higher energies in electron recoil. The LSND analysis that Maxime did was based on a window between 18 and 52 MeV, and they could do that because the LSND detector was a Cherenkov detector, which had good angular resolution at low energies. The LINA detector is a scintillator detector, which has poor resolution at low energies. And so as I explained, we want to work above the decay at rest threshold to get rid of the backgrounds, which will be totally, which will totally swamp us. Then there are two other factors which turn out not to matter because of this issue of being systematics limited, but might matter if you could fix that. So higher luminosity and larger acceptance. So Daedalus has 10 times more protons in a year than LSND did in the entire experiment. And as opposed to the LSND detector being 8 meters long, LINA is 100 meters long, and you can put it right next to it and get a larger angular acceptance. But if your sensitivity scales as S over B, none of that matters, because you get that many more signal events, that many more background events, and you don't improve at all. So you would like these things to matter. So there's some way of reducing the uncertainties on these CCQE processes that would help. OK, so let me just show you some sensitivity curves. So the first one is, how do the LSND bounds change based on this observation that you can have off-shell production of dark photons that then give you dark matter? So the previous results sort of extracted from the plots that I showed you near the beginning of the talk had these sharp cutoffs at the pion mass and at twice the dark matter mass. But there are two regimes where you can have an off-shell dark photon, what I'll call the lower and the upper regime. So lower is where MA prime is less than 2 M chi, and upper is where MA prime is greater than M pi. And you have sensitivity in both these regimes. So the reason you get an extension up here is, so you're penalized out here by an extra factor of alpha dark, but here we're, if we take alpha dark of 0.1, so something not too small, then this slope is actually not too steep, and you can actually get, if you extend this plot further, you can get significant sensitivity out here. And in fact, if you look down here, the sensitivity to epsilon squared at very low mass, even though you're off shell, is better than your maximum sensitivity when you're on shell. Wait, the scattering is larger, and you're not, so basically you have two denominators, which are like 1 over q squared minus ma prime squared. But if ma prime is small, you don't get so much of a suppression in either production or in scattering. So you win. And so here you do have a real threshold, because there's some competition between the three-body and the two-body processes here, and some phase-space considerations. But it's not a sharp cutoff. It's sort of this softer threshold.
But in detection, usually your detection threshold would impose some Q-squared threshold, right?
Sure. I mean, for the same Q-squared threshold, you're, for a lighter dark photon, you're penalized less than the denominator. I mean, like, you might not have guessed that this would end up dipping below that. You might have guessed that this thing will extend out and won't cut off sharply. But it turns out that as you go to lower masses, you win, at least for the cuts that LSND chose. I think here, because again, this is for the low energy window, and so there's, I mean, the recoil like at 18 MeV is, yeah.
So Q squared is going to be
Yeah, I mean, it's basically there's some coincidence in mass. I mean, the fact that this thing is, you know, on the same order as the mass of the A prime, that's where the shape comes from.
Somewhere it should
flatten
out.
Right. I mean, sure. If you get all the way down here, I mean, certainly at 2 ME, you know, then different things happen. But one interesting thing to point out is that there is an LSND analysis which has a higher energy window. They were looking to measure a charge current process. And what we found is that you can get excellent sensitivity by looking at high energies. And it seems like there's no good reason why LSND didn't look at higher energies. I mean, they're looking for a different process. But there's a potential to run this exact same analysis with existing data, which could potentially give stronger bounds than even the ones that we're getting from Daedalus. So that's an avenue worth exploring. So some sensitivities as you fix the dark matter mass. So these are closer to the plots that, that you might be familiar with. But here, so there are various kinematic thresholds. So for a light Kai, say just one MeV, the threshold where the lower off-shell region is not even on the plot, and so you only have the one where MA prime gets heavier than the pion. But the point is that this curve just kind of softly continues up here. There's no sharp threshold here at all, and so you do indeed have some reach above the pion mass. And that thing extends to any experiment which is trying to produce dark matter or dark photons through meson decays. You know, not just pions, but etas and other stuff, maybe at higher energies. The plot looks a whole lot more interesting at this sort of medium mass range, where you have both of these thresholds. So the LSND plot that I showed you in the last slide is here, and then Daedalus does a little bit better across the whole region of parameter space. But one thing to note is that in this range down here, visible searches probe the same region of parameter space as this invisibly decaying search. And this is for the reasons that I mentioned earlier, is that you have a strong branching fraction into E plus E minus, and so searches that are looking for E plus E minus are going to compete with a three-body process which produces dark matter. And those things, again, actually there's no sharp cutoff here because, of course, you're going to have some extremely tiny branching ratio to E plus E minus in this region, but functionally, because epsilon is so small, the visible searches basically just cut off at this threshold.
Sorry, somebody from the outside.
Yeah.
These plots are beginning to look a lot like the MSSM. I'm sorry, this is a joke. But initially, you get a formula for the dark matter abundance, and there was M chi there.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So what are the preferred values for this? Because you're plotting 1 and 20.
So good. So it's not. So the MSSM has 106 parameters. We have 4.
I know.
Okay. I know. I just want to get that out there. Okay. So unfortunately, we're humans and we like thinking in 2 dimensions. I mean, if you could just think in 4 dimensions, great. Let's just make some 4-dimensional plots and look everywhere. So what you're talking about is you want to pin the abundance down.
Yeah.
But what I was trying to argue is that a lot of the motivation for this is thinking of this as a subdominant component of dark matter.
Okay.
And in that case, all you care about is not overclosing the universe. And it turns out that if you take the dark gauge coupling large enough, it's going to annihilate so much away that maybe this is not a component of astrophysical dark matter in a sense you could ever measure, but it's a particle in the spectrum, and let's go look for it. So.
Eric is right. These two plots share a lot in common, and that the main thing is nothing is found so far.
Yes. Sure. But it's interesting. It's interesting. I guess it's kind of analysis to these these windows in the MSSM where you have these mass coincidences and they make some particle hard to look for. But it's interesting phenomenology, which until now had not really been emphasized in this dark photon model. So.
I just want to get the picture.
Yeah. Okay. So here's 2 more pictures. You can slice this thing any way you want. It's also illustrative to slice it at fixed dark photon mass and then sweep the dark matter mass. And in there, the off-shell and on-shell regimes just switch. So as chi gets heavier, then the A prime gets off-shell. And in that case, these visible searches show up as horizontal lines. The reason being, they don't care about the dark matter mass. They only care about the A prime mass, which is fixed here. So you have various constraints for beam dumps. Basically, what you do is you go look at your visible plot, you find what the value of epsilon squared is at that value of MA prime that I've picked up there, and you just draw a horizontal line there. And again, the Daedalus setup does a little bit better than LSND, and a little bit better than BDX in some regions, and a little bit worse in some other regions. But again, it's interesting that you have regions of parameter space which are constrained by other experiments which are looking for different signals entirely. So I think the most...
Can I just make one comment? I mean, I think looking at this simple model where you just have one dark matter particle,
mm-hmm.
one invisible particle and visible decay, one gauge goes on,
yeah.
is a good thing to do.
Yeah.
But part of the reason that these other constraints are not always shown is that they're not always there. Right?
Yeah.
So you can consider models with additional... It's very easy to have an additional invisible particle whose branching range, whose coupling to the dark photon is still small, so you're not necessarily going to see it in the re-scattering process.
Sure.
But is larger than the decay to the visible sector, because, for example, there's some other epsilon over there in their sector that has that's larger than 10^-4.
Sure.
So there is an interesting model-dependent complementarity. I totally agree, and I think it's worth exploring.
Yeah.
But it's also model-dependent, so part of the reason that at least I've tried to not show these contours in my papers is that it gives the impression that, for example, the parameter space that's already tested by E137 is in the visible decay channels not worth looking at in the invisible channels.
Yeah.
That's the message it conveys, but I think
it's good. So the one robust thing is this off-shell business.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, if you have coupling to chi and E plus E minus, you always have a three-body width and you should always care about that. So yes, but I agree that so putting this on there is potentially a little bit misleading, but you can always add your caveats that this is the only dark sector state. So I think the most interesting slicing through parameter space is as follows. So what this is I'm fixing the kinetic mixing epsilon. And I'm fixing it as follows. So let me go back to this plot. And imagine that I sweep along the bottom of this band, which is saying the value of epsilon squared that lets you explain the G minus U anomaly. So for every value of MA prime, I'm going to pin epsilon to be the bottom of this band. So it's some non-linear slicing through parameter space. Once I do that, and once I pick a value of the dark matter mass, I'm now left with two parameters and I can draw a plot on a plane. And so that's what I'm doing here. We're fixing the dark matter mass, we're fixing the kinetic mixing to explain G minus 2, and now we're sweeping over the remaining two parameters. And the reason this is nice is that you don't have to assume anything about the branching ratios of this A prime into E plus E minus or into dark matter. It's fixed, it's just determined by this and alpha dark and the epsilon that you chose. And so you can draw a boundary, which is the 50% line, so branching ratio along this line is 50% to either dark sector or standard model states. And then you can ask, what does the allowed parameter space look like? And this is saying, for that dark matter mass, what region is left that explains the G minus 2 anomaly? So the old plots were here, and you can see the LSNU results are cutting off, or approaching infinite slope around the pion mass, but the reanalysis says that that's not quite true, that you have some reach that extends out. It's not so much, but what the Daedalus setup will do is let you scan a lot of this parameter range, and you can see there's still allowed regions before Daedalus, here and here, and Daedalus cuts off basically all of them except for this kind of window down there. And so you asked about deltas, and they start to matter right here. So we were hoping that actually if you include the additional dark matter you get from delta to n gamma or n a prime, you might now cover this whole thing. It turns out it doesn't quite work. You don't quite have enough of them. They don't quite have enough kinetic energy. But this is not a huge window. And so you might have some options there. And also just to mention that so this dark light experiment also has, it can do both a visible and invisible search, and it has sensitivity to some of the region which is not totally excluded yet. So the G minus 2 window for a dark photon explanation is definitely closing, but it's not dead yet. So just to summarize, we can produce MEV scale dark matter at the Daedalus cyclotron through this rare three-body pion decay. We can then detect its rescattering through electron scattering at a big neutrino detector like LINA. The backgrounds turn out to be charge current backgrounds and not neutrino elastic scattering as one might have expected. And those are the main background up to very high energies. But despite that, we still have a reach of this experiment which is stronger than the existing LSND results by an order of magnitude over some significant portion of parameter space. So to conclude, pairing Daedalus with a suitable neutrino detector can improve the LSND results by an order of magnitude after just a year. I mean, again, the time doesn't really matter here because you're not winning by getting more rate, but you're just sort of maybe getting enough events that you can claim that you're above Poisson fluctuations. The off-shell reach is surprisingly strong, especially in this lower region where you can have stronger reach for light off-shell dark photons than for on-shell ones. And this is important for the whole program of dark photon searches that are initiated by meson decay. Like Miniboon should now look for off-shell decays to off-shell dark photons from both pions and etas and other heavier mesons. And there's a nice symbiosis between neutrino and dark matter communities in the coming years, basically because we can just use their experiments, we can run it at the same time, we can do the analyses side by side, and kind of get two physics programs for the price of one. Thanks.
By looking at the different energy, right?
Exactly, by optimizing the signal window. Yeah, because this is a dedicated analysis. LSND was like, we have this data, let's just reanalyze it.
Why do you need such a huge detector? I mean, why couldn't you just
Well, number one, because it was already there for the neutrino experiment. They needed a big detector. And number two, because it's not inconceivable that you might be able to reduce, if you reduce the systematic uncertainty on the charge current processes down enough, you're going to start to be statistics dominant anyway. And then you'll win by having a bigger detector.
Okay, so V9 is built already, right?
No, it's proposed, but it's...
And it's been funded?
I'm actually not sure what the current status is. So people were talking about doing a search like this at like Nova, which already exists, but Nova's not underground. And so then I think the cosmic backgrounds are going to be prohibitive. So I think at this point there's not a big enough neutrino detector, underground neutrino detector, to be able to do this exact setup. But I might be wrong.
Yeah. Well, so I guess maybe a variation on Andrew's question is, if you imagine shrinking the detector volume,
yeah,
at what point would your statistical uncertainty become comparable to that 0.2 e?
Good question. I'm not sure off the top of my head, but you could conceivably do this with a somewhat smaller detector, but then you have the issue also that you have this intense cyclotron. And if you're combining a lower flux with a smaller detector, those two things will go in the same direction, and then you might start losing faster.
Well, sorry, I'm happy to imagine putting this Daedalus cyclotron next to Super K or something.
Sure. I think then Hyper K is probably, the time scales for that work out
right
more closely, but I think that the Daedalus cyclotron is not going to get built until Venus builds, I think. Because in their proposal, they have three.
So,
they have Daedalus and Hyper-K, Daedalus and Lina.
Okay, so that's basically a sociological comment?
Exactly, yeah. So, Daedalus is looking for neutrino detectors, and we can just piggyback on them. So, yeah.
So, returning to the minimal model, which is a standard model, you talked about the experimentalists about using this, neutrino charge interaction of these neutrinos that produced the scalicity forbidden decay of pi plus, which is decay in flight, is the one that sticks out.
Yeah.
As a diagnostic tool for whatever is. If it wasn't simulated before or included, it might be this high energy end of.
Right.
Electrons can be used as a calibration, right, for whatever they're doing.
That's a good point. The problem is I think that has the same uncertainties, or maybe more uncertainties, on the other nuclear processes. Let me back up. So when they're trying to measure charge current rates, they use elastic scattering as calibration, because there are no systematics on that, because it's just neutrino electron. If they're looking for elastic scattering, then they use charge current processes for calibration. And in that case, this one that you mentioned might be important, but they also have any number of other processes they can use to get a handle on. So I'm not sure how important this process would be for a neutrino experiment specifically, but I think it's worth.
But this is the one that would produce like the highest energy.
That's right.
And it's very sensitively dependent on what's the fraction of the pions decay and fly,
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it has some diagnostic features inside.
Yeah, absolutely. So we haven't talked to them yet about this, but we're thinking about talking to some other neutrino experimentalists for basically trying to optimize the setup. Like, suppose you didn't need a giant block of stuff to stop your pions, and suppose you didn't need an enormous neutrino detector. Suppose you could somehow sweep all the backgrounds out of the way. What would be the optimal setup for such a search? And so I think then that would be a good time to ask that question.
Any other questions?
So what about neutrons? Are there any neutron backgrounds? 20 meters isn't that far away. Oh.
You mean from the source?
From the source, yeah.
I was led to believe they were going to be subdominant to all this stuff. But again, the point is you don't need to put it 20 meters away. So you could decide how far away to put it such that the backgrounds would be negligible.
Neutrons don't seem
to work. Yeah, I'm not sure. You'd have to have some neutron-nuclear interaction. But
I mean, I think
the neutrons come in and they spoil.
Yeah, the neutron, you know, penetrate. I mean, I would imagine even get away from this by the neutron.
The detector has a bunch of shielding, which might matter for this stuff.
If they just pick out the proton, that's not good. I mean, you have to do so.
Yeah, because they're looking at some energetic electron, the neutron backs. I mean,
the neutron backs
are more important that you have a detector with sensitivity down to the low energy recoiling nucleons, right?
Right.
Which this does not.
Okay, let's thank you.